between 1920 and 1960, the technological landscape of Britain's farms underwent a profound change, as horses were displaced by tractors as the prime source of ground power. In 1921, there were just under a million horses used for agricultural purposes in the UK, and just 25,000 tractors. By 1959, in contrast, there were over 500,000 tractors, while the horse population had dropped to somewhere under 100,000. The numbers no longer deemed significant enough for the Ministry of Agriculture to collect after the 1958 agricultural census. Given such figures, it is perhaps unsurprising that this change was often described at the time, and subsequently by many historians, as a technological revolution. Yet the two technologies were in use side by side on many farms for nearly half a century. And so if there was a revolution, it was a remarkably slow one, in which the benefits of the tractor and the deficiencies of the horse were far from self-evident to the farmers who used them. Historical studies told us very little about the nature of this 50-year transition. They focused more on the technical potential of tractors and the economic ability of farmers to acquire them, and on farmers changing attitudes towards horses, which they regard as going into an inevitable decline. My thesis argues that this portrayal is reductive and misguided, because one source of ground power cannot be understood in isolation from the other. The tractor arrived into an agricultural world that had been comprehensively designed around the horse. For decades was maintained, used, and understood in relationship to it. This involved an ongoing negotiation of the animal-machine boundary, as experts and farmers navigated the best way to incorporate new technologies into existing farming systems. In this paper, I detail three successive and qualitatively different ways in which farmers perceived the horse-tractor relationship. The first period, from the arrival of tractors on British farms until the late 1930s, saw tractors and horses widely understood as complementary rather than competitive technologies. A significant distinction existed between animal and machine. The tractors regarded as an inherently mechanical technology, operating successfully within a specific niche in a fundamentally horse-powered agricultural system. The second period, from the late 1930s until the early 1950s, saw tractors increasingly conceptualised and used as mechanical horses. Rather than competing as a revolutionarily mechanical technology, they gained a foothold on many farms by essentially becoming more horse-like. And finally, from the early 1950s onwards, tractor emerged from under the shadow of the horse to become a distinctive technology in its own right, against which horses were compared, and for the first time, found wanting. Into all British farms were economically, socially, technically, and even physically shaped for and by the labour of horses, from the size of fields and the gateposts that provided access to them, to the farmyard hierarchy and the pattern of the working day. Internal combustion engine tractors were not the first mechanical draft power source to arrive into this context and work alongside them. By the 1920s, many farms had been using steam engines for nearly a century. Rather than replacing horses, steam engines had settled into a niche, being used primarily for providing power by belt-drive threshing machines and for heavy cultivation, such as ploughing in wet clay soil. Although they were widely valued for these roles, in other crucial areas they offered little improvement, or were indeed considered to have significant disadvantages when compared to horses. Instead of competing, they became regarded as complementary. In 1921, for example, the authors of the manual Agriculture Theoretical and Practical emphasised that there was, quote, room for both horse and steam power on British farms. In the interwar period, farmers and agricultural experts quite evidently applied their understanding of how steam engines and horses had occupied the same technological landscape to the new technology of the tractor. They argued that just as the steam engine had not displaced the horse, so too nobody was seriously suggesting that the tractor would either. Different draft power technologies continue to be regarded as complementary, each being the most efficient source of power for specific sets of tasks and circumstances. At a 1928 conference on power farming, a representative of a Bedford agricultural firm, engineering firm, summarised this view. I believe the horse, the tractor and the steam tackle with their suitable implements hold an important place in the development of our farming industry. And where well and wisely employed, even under existing conditions, all three can be used with progressive and profitable results. Initially then, tractors didn't disrupt the prevailing perspective on the relationship between animal and machine technologies. Like steam engines, early tractors were valued for their ability to provide significant additional power during work peaks, such as ploughing and harvesting, rather than for any potential ability to take on all farm work. Indeed, E.J.T. Collins has argued, many early tractors were replacing not horses at all, but rather the larger, more cumbersome steam engines which had previously ride with his top-up car. Mechanisation enthusiasts even warned against the excessive use of tractors. In his 1938 Guide to Farm Machinery, for example, Claude Culpin noted that farmers should be wary of unnecessarily using tractors for all sorts of light work which horses could perform better. Despite the proliferation of mechanised alternatives then, horses were still commonly regarded as the primary source of drag power. In 1928, Watson and Moore remarked that, quote, in Britain, the normal working unit is a team of two horses, unquote. And by 1939, they were still doing the majority of farm work on farms. Horses and tractors were not widely understood to be analogous or interchangeable. The primary reason early tractors were seen to be most efficient within these particular niches was the widespread lack until the late 1930s of a pneumatic tyre on standard models. Metal wheels, like this one here, with protruding cleats or lugs, had caused a range of practical problems for farmers, which limited their use and prevented them from really taking on the status of mechanical horse. They provided a good grip on soil, but they were unsuitable for more delicate tasks, such as haymaking, as they compressed loose hay into the ground. It was also forbidden for lug wheels to be driven on public roads, and the available conversion grounds were found to be time-consuming to attach and unreliable in performance. Farmers preferred instead to leave their machines in the field overnight, with consequent problems for their ongoing maintenance. Heavily treaded pneumatic tyres answered all of these objections, giving good traction in both heavy and delicate field work, but also were able to be driven straight from the field onto the road. More than any other technology, then, it was the pneumatic tyre which provided tractors with the versatility to take on the general purpose role that hitherto horses had dominated, and so starting to break down that animal mechanical boundary between the two technologies. Although the demand for power and the economic environment of the Second World War unarguably supported the rapid increase in the pace of tractor adoption during the 1940s, this widespread adoption of pneumatic tyres enabled those tractors to move beyond their previously specialist role towards the general purpose role previously occupied by horses. Having acquired the ability to move freely throughout the farm landscape, tractors have become truly competitive with horses, therefore, not by their radical mechanical difference, but by a sense of imitation. In this period, it became increasingly common for agricultural experts and even manufacturers to appeal to the sense of similarity of the tractor as equine machine. And it is through practices of care and maintenance that we can see most clearly this animal-machine boundary being broken down. Aspects of labour until recently neglected by historians and technology, care and maintenance were shifting in contested categories. The terms were often deployed in surprising and interesting ways in discussions about how such labour might contribute to or hinder the goal of efficient farming. Caring for horses is a round-the-clock job. They needed to be fed, groomed and given fresh water and bedding 7 days a week, every week of the year, whether a horse was needed for a full day's work, just a short task, or not at all. It's unsurprising then that those early marketing materials frequently emphasised the ease and efficiency of tractor maintenance in comparison with the drudgery of stable work. One Sussex farmer recalled, for example, that in the 1930s, a tractor salesman tried to sell his uncle a tractor on the basis that, unlike a horse, it, quote, doesn't eat when it's not working. In general, the maintenance needs of a tractor did appear to be less critical than the needs of a horse. They needed fuel and water only when working, could work extremely long hours without the need for rest, and once returned to the barn at the end of the day, could, if necessary, be forgotten about until next needed. For early enthusiasts, tractors seemed provide greater efficiency of work hours because less of the day was taken up with maintenance tasks. But tractors did need maintenance, often a great deal more than many farmers first realised. And in impressing that fact on farmers, expert advisors used the intuitive and emotive aspects of horse care as a reference point, actively blurring the animal-machine boundary. A film produced by the Ford Motor Company in the early 1950s neatly illustrates some of the ways in which these ideas about horse care and tractor maintenance have become entangled. It follows two Fords and tractor users, Farmer Brown and Farmer Green, the former a good maintainer and the latter an almost comically bad one. To emphasise the importance of good maintenance, the narrator reminds viewing farmers that, quote, when you were using horses, they were probably the pride of your life. Nothing was too good for them, unquote. Farmer Green, who had known how to properly care for his horses, just didn't see that the mechanical innards have to be cared for as much as a horse's innards. The film is particularly interesting for the way in which it directly compares the apparently natural ability of farmers to properly care for horses with a desired similar affinity for tract maintenance, one which Farmer Green clearly yet to acquire. According to many observers then, this desired mechanical turn of mind should draw directly on past experiences of the use of horsepower. It should treat the modern machine with the intuitive and subjective art of care as much as any scientific process of diagnosis and routine maintenance. The exercise instead the need for an almost emotive connection as well as practical mechanical skill with tractors in order to understand them well enough to work them efficiently. Many refer to the importance of a driver knowing an individual engine. Quote, to be successful, the driver must feel with his machine. Quote. Writers applied obvious animal analogies to tractors, speaking of them as though they were living technologies with which users needed to develop a working relationship. This was both overt and subtle, from encouraging owners to treat their machinery as they would treat their animals, for example, to talking of the diseases from which an engine suffers, or referring to engines as stubborn. Similarly, S.J. Wright, who's the first director of the newly created National Institute of Agricultural Engineering, speaking in 1942, argued that farmers of the last generation had the knack of horsemanship. They knew at a glance whether the horses were in good condition and whether they were doing their job properly. Some of them very nearly knew what the horses were thinking, and what is more, some of the horses very nearly knew what the ploughman was thinking. It would take a few more generations of mechanical power before farmers had the same instinct as the tractors and tractor implements. And that is the main reason why we don't get as much work out of the average tractor as we ought. As tractors have become more horse-like in their operation, then, agriculturalists had also increasingly encouraged farmers to treat them as though they are more horse-like. In the early 1950s, however, a range of technical features have become common on tractors, which enabled and necessitated the increasing understanding of them as a fundamentally and qualitatively different track power technology to the horse, redefining that animal-machine distinction again in new ways. Those features were power takeoff, or PTO for short, and hydraulic lifts for mounted implements based on Harry Ferguson's famous patented three-point linkage. Many agricultural implements have complex mechanisms, such as moving knife blades, crop conveyors, and binders. And prior to PTO, these were powered by a large ground wheel turned by the forward motion of the implement. But although simple, this solution could encounter difficulties. So in very wet weather or a dense crop, for example, the ground wheel could fail to acquire sufficient traction or become clogged. So the horse or tractor would continue to drag the implement, but the mechanism would no longer operate and quickly become blocked. PTO enabled tractors to avoid such delays in a way that the horse simply couldn't, by delivering power from the engine directly to drive the mechanism of the implement being towed. Further, the mechanism of an implement could be easily turned off when the tractor was turning in the headlands, or conversely, it could be left in operation whilst the tractor remained stationary. So in combination with a hydraulic lift, then, a mounted implement could be controlled with significant precision by a single tractor driver, using a clutch draw brake power takeoff and a simple lever to moderate the height of the implement in the ground or lift it out entirely. Cornelius Davis summarised the impact of this on the perceived role of horses and tractors in his 1958 manual Mechanised Agriculture, arguing that the modern tractor can do things beyond the capabilities of the best trained farm horses. Once again, they were seen to be fundamentally different technologies, as having already acquired the ability to operate across all farm operations, tractors acquired additional capabilities beyond the reach of any horse. As a result, experts and farmers began in this post-war period to talk for the first time about not only the possibility, but the inevitability of the complete removal of all horses from farms. Explicitly placing horses alongside oxen in the animal technological path, Claude Culpin wrote in 1951 that the individual farmer could no more afford to return to horsework today than he could afford in the 1870s to change back from horses to oxen. Indeed, he needs to consider whether he has gone far enough in the replacement of horses, rather than whether he has gone too far. Not only did agricultural communities begin to envisage a horse's agricultural future, they also set about reshaping the farm's physical, economic, and social structure around the tractor as the prime power unit. In his 1954 manual on mechanisation, Henderson asked farmers, "Can you reorganise a section of your farm so that a machine can be made to achieve the purpose in mind? Or would it be wise to cut out a farm enterprise entirely if the cost of mechanising it is too high?" He also encouraged farmers to be conscious of the subtle ongoing influences of horses on the farm landscape and to consider carrying out maintenance with a newly tractor-oriented perspective. as well as making changes to simply accommodate tractors, such as the removal of hedgerows to combine fields. Therefore, experts encourage farmers to actively eradicate the traces of horse infrastructure, such as levelling the old ruts of horse-drawn cart tracks or concreting new tracks in the farm road to suit the width of tractor wheels. So I've argued that the widespread understandings of the relationship between the two technologies underwent significant changes during the course of their interaction, and I've noted three identifiable phases. In the first, from the early tractors in the 1910s and 20s to the late 1930s, farmers understood the range of existing and new animal and machine technologies to be complementary rather than competitive. The animal nature of horses and the mechanical nature of tractors seemed to provide them with specialist niches within the farming system, in which each was the most efficient technology. In the second phase, from the late 1930s until the early 1950s, the apparently simple addition of pneumatic tyres provided tractors with the ability to more fully emulate the horse. Though most commentators still felt that the horse had a permanent future, even if in significantly diminished numbers. As the two technologies began to be seen as more interchangeable in farming operations, however, experts increasingly turned to an idealised past of horse care as a frame for the model relationship a farmer should have with his machines. Finally, with the widespread adoption of power takeoff and pneumatic implements in the early 1950s, the animal-machine distinction was once again reinforced, as the tractor acquired fundamentally new capabilities, and farmers started to remove not only the horses from their farms, but also the embedded traces of the horse-shaped landscape. John Martin has argued that the dominance of the two horsepower unit in British farming overshadowed the actual decline of horses in this period. That although horses were still widely in use, their influence was significantly waning. I suggest that the inverse of this is true, that their long but dramatic population decline distracts from, or even obscures, the considerable influence they continue to exert. That influence is to be found not in their own agricultural labour, but in the manner in which farmers adopted, maintained, used the technology which eventually replaced them. Those tractors were incorporated into an agricultural context shaped for and by horses, used alongside and in conjunction with horses for over four decades, and the ideals of tractor use and maintenance were throughout the period discussed by both farmers and experts in both emulational and in purposeful contrast to equine technological practices. With this in mind, I suggest that we can usefully think about the tractor as an equine machine. By doing so, we move our understanding of the transition from one in which the tractor revolutionised agriculture by simply, yet slowly, replacing the horse, to one in which the tractor underwent a lengthy and complex interaction with the horse, and so crucially, was fundamentally shaped by it.